Back in the dark ages when I was in the broadcasting business, what I'm going to be doing today, we used to call rip and read, because you'd go in and pull off the wire copy from the broadcast news wire, and without ever having previewed it, you'd read it on the air, and whatever happened, happened. That's kind of the position I'm in today. I got this sermon at 5 minutes, before this service started, so here goes. Reimagining the American Dream, which is a sermon by Reverend Marilyn Sewell, who is the minister emeritus of First Unitarian Universalist Church in Portland, Oregon. The early settlers who risked life and limb to come to this land, a land strange and unknown but full of promise, these early settlers had a dream. That dream included freedom to worship as they wished, and it included the opportunity to prosper. If they were willing to work hard, it included the possibility of owning their own land, plowing their own field, not being the landless servant or serf they would have been in the old country, where class systems were rigidly enforced and life was absolutely locked into place by rank and birth order. Although this dream promised much to the individual, it was also a dream grounded in a holy covenant with God and with one another. Hear the words of Governor Winthrop even before his people disembarked from their ship to set foot in this promised land. He said, "We are entered into covenant with for this work. We have taken out a commission." And he continues, "We must be knit together in brotherly affection. We must be willing to abridge ourselves of our superfluities and for the supply of each other's necessities." And then he moved to the responsibility in this new settlement to the larger world. "For we must consider that we shall be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us, a statement of manifest destiny. We shall be a shining example to the rest of the world, a moral light that will guide others into ways of mercy and justice." This was 1630. This was an amazing dream, the political piece of which was further articulated and framed in a document which came some 140 years later, of which you may have heard, a document that made a heretofore unimaginable claim that all men are created equal, they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. All people have precisely the same rights. Unheard of. This was the American dream. Granted, all people did not fall under the purview of that dream at that time. Women did not, slaves did not, men who did not own property did not, and Native Americans didn't exactly get a fair share. But the ideal remained. And though through the centuries we have worked to enlarge the scope of that dream, we have come to have some success, of which we are rightly proud. But the essence of the dream has been shaken and changed. What has happened to the sacred covenant with ourselves, with our God, to one another? What has happened to that noble experiment to the country that was to be a city upon a hill, leading other nations to righteousness and justice? We are a nation where freedom has now been interpreted to mean that the strong don't have to care for the weak. We are a nation that stinks from corruption at the top, a nation which dresses itself in God language while pandering unashamedly to the rich and ignoring the poor. We are a nation where hatred prevails, reviled by many other nations with grudgingly tolerated by those who would count us as their friends. We are far from being that city upon a hill, that moral compass for other nations. Rather, we have decided to build an empire, one that in which a few might flourish at the expense of the many. Now, with our economy in shambles, with greed and corruption so apparent to all, we have finally awakened to the hard truth that easy money helped us to avoid some truths for a long time. The economic system that we thought was sound that could always be fixed turned out to be a house of cards based on false premises and inflated profit sheets. The good news is that we have come to a point of reckoning. We have had forced upon us a time of reflection that carries with it the possibility of radical change. I say radical because radical means from the root, and no amount of shifting or tweaking will do when there is so little in the solid core. Our problems turn out to be rooted not so much in economic malfeasance as in spiritual decadence. We have come to understand that the story we have been living by, the cultural narrative, is defunct. I refer to the cultural story of the nation, ostensibly about bringing freedom and democracy to all the world. In truth, about building empire. But I'm also referring to the cultural story for the individual. That which defines middle class goals and aspirations, it is all about competition and getting mine. It goes something like this. You work on your resume starting at about age 2 or 3. You get into a good elementary school. You get into a good high school. You get into a good university where you'll make the right connections, graduate, get a good job or a series of them, get married, buy a nice house, and have 2.3 children. Work hard and consume, buy a lot, get old, die. This is not a dream worthy of our lives. This will not render a life that will model anything worthy for our children. The emptiness of it will become apparent as these young people reach out for meaning in a society in which the parents serve an economic system that no longer serves them. There is no bailing out a system that is ungrounded in relationship. Bereft of moral principle, we have to build from the bottom up on new ground, new premises. Economics, as I see it, is fundamentally a moral discipline. Economics defines our material relationships with one another. That is, who gets what of the resources of a society. And economics defines our relationship with the natural environment. We're extracting or extracting from Mother Earth, and for what purposes? Now when we tell our children, starting in their very first year, we say, now Johnny, you have to learn to share. That's economics. Or we say to our 2-year-old, let's recycle that juice box. That's economics. Thank you. The problem with economics, as it's treated academically and in the business world, is that its ethical and moral issues are often left out of the conversation. After all, economics is a science, they tell us. Was it John Kenneth Galbraith who said once, if you put all the economists in the world to an end, there would be a good thing? We use formulas, we measure, we predict, and moral issues cannot easily be figured into the equation. Maybe not, but we should consider that the most important things in the world are the things that do not yield easily to the scientific method. The movement of socialist and communist systems toward free markets is correct. They need feedback because complex systems cannot function well without various dependable feedback loops. But a major error of neoclassical economics is its over-reliance on only one form of feedback. It looks at prices and markets and little else. Social and environmental costs are excluded, but unemployment and underemployment are feedback. Global warming is feedback, and economies seized by fear. That's feedback too. Economists have taught us to reify the economy, or to make it seem like a system of rules and regulations that are real and tangible, a system delivered from on high, a system that just is like air or water and is not amenable to change. But the system has been imagined by human beings or on assumptions made by human beings, and therefore it can be changed by human beings. So let's take a look at the values that have run the country's economy and our lives in this moment. I think we'd have to use the words like profit, production, efficiency, consumption, creation of capital. Now let me make myself clear. There is nothing wrong with those words. It's just that they are not ends in and of themselves. They should exist to serve values larger than themselves, human values. They should exist to serve the common good, to serve human health and well-being, to ensure the care and sustainability of Earth. There are important questions we need to ask. Does our economic system exist to serve families, or does family structure exist to serve the economic structure? Why do both parents have to work outside the home? Why do we have so little interaction with family members, not even eating together in many cases? Are social structures arranged to bring generations together or to pull them apart? Do work structures exist to support parenting, the building of community, the work of citizen activists, or the efficiency of the economic machine? The economic meltdown will help us to begin ask the right questions, and so will the peaking of fossil fuels, which will soon be upon us. When oil is no longer cheap, and that time will come again, and soon our economic life will shift dramatically. We will be more and more focused locally. We will eat more local food, trade with small businesses who are close at hand, find ways to work that are more amenable to family life instead of commuting miles each day. We will walk and bike and use transit instead of driving. We will not fly thousands of miles away from home to meetings or to vacation 3 or 4 times a year. We will live closer together. We will share more of ourselves, more of the time. We will mend instead of buying new. Some of us urban dwellers will weave and knit and plant and grow. Change is already happening, and more will come. This is one of those rare openings in which scales have fallen from the national eyes, and it is clear to almost everyone that the emperor has no clothes. The good news is that we will now have the opportunity to reimagine an economy we want, the kind of life we want to live. We will take advantage of the moment. We will reimagine. We will reform the American dream. It's not that people don't understand that we have a problem. It's that people have had their imaginations drained out of them by the constant barrage of messages they receive about consuming, and they have had their energies drained by jobs that have longer and longer hours and less meaning. So what is our part? The place to begin is at home, that is with ourselves. Notice what is life-denying and resist it. Just say no for your sake and your children's sake. Live with the moral authority that comes from compassion and nonviolence. Form communities of people who will sustain you in living as you wish to live, whether they are study groups or alternative living arrangements or socially responsible, sustainable businesses. Our churches should be central gathering places for such a community. Now we can structure our lives to serve the economy. What would an economy look like that was structured to serve the people? How would you like to live? How can you make it happen? The idealism that caused John Winthrop to say that we have a special destiny, and that destiny is to be a city upon the hill, is not dead. In this country, I see certain young people who are quietly living in a way respectful to our earth. I see it in many creative people who have a vision way beyond the popular mind. I know that whenever the human spirit is willing to join the larger spirit, that new dreams can be dreamed and whole nations can be moved. Whoever thought the Berlin Wall would come crashing down? When the time was right, it came down. Whoever thought that Nelson Mandela would get out of prison after 28 years and lead his nation? But in time, it happened. I am convinced that what is life denying, what is repressive and false, will be known as such, and people who are basically good will follow a new way. Let us be some of those who step out and lead, who dare to become once again the light that blesses the world. Our closing hymn is number